This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Why am I sitting on this panel? I grew up with the survivors who were my father's aunts and uncles. My own grandfather, who actually, from a technical respect, wasn't a survivor because he jumped on a boat in 1937. When I mean jumped on, it's like after it had started to pull away from the dock without a ticket. He was a stowaway whose family actually ransomed him from the captain when he got to New York in 37. And then he went back to Europe, actually as a GI, to become naturalized, which was not an uncommon way in which you could just sort of get around that sort of illegal loop if you were sort of young and strong and willing to die. So I grew up in that environment, especially after Pesach is very strong for me because we always had Seder together, and the Holocaust was the central theme of our Seder, which is maybe something we'll get to later. But probably more than anything else, I didn't just grow up. I was the first recipient of my Aunt Helene, great Aunt Helene's stories when I was about 11. You know, my education, as I'm sure is true of many people here, centered on the Holocaust, and go home, ask someone in your family about the Holocaust. And when I asked, she finally began to speak, to the point where, if you know the Spielberg project called something, the Shoah Project, okay, fine. We have her recording. At the end of it, the camera pulls back to her children and her grandchildren, and her son says, "I never knew these stories." And that, to me, was the most astounding and revelatory part of the film, because I knew about 60, 70% of what she said, which is a lot. And when I say that, I'm talking about images of people being dragged to death behind wagons and babies dying from people's hands and all the classic things that I'm sure you've heard about. But for me, what's important being on this panel is sharing both thoughts about the Holocaust and what that is for me as a human being, as a Jew, as an educator. So that's the short answer. Oh, I thought we were just answering that first, and then we're going back to this.
No, you can.
Okay, now then, so I guess I kind of already answered the first. How has it influenced my Jewish identity in worldview and in action? First of all, I'd say the layer of the Holocaust for me that's most present these days is psycho-emotional. The sense that you really shouldn't trust the world. It's just not to be relied on. And therefore, either you live without a fear or an intensive readiness, which doesn't lend itself to softness, desire to see the world through the eyes of other, moments of vulnerability, etc. So I would say that's an important topography for me as a human being. And how is it my Jewish identity? More of a where here I am. I mean, when I first came to Israel at age 15, I remember my Aunt Helene tearfully giving me notes to put into the kotel. Now, I should say that they were frum shebefrum, as we say. They were extremely religious family. She talks about the rabbi used to stay in their house, and they would sleep around the stove so that he and his students could have their bedrooms, etc. They were decently well off. And so, but, you know, like so many families, they left a lot of that behind in Europe. So my decision to start coming to Israel and then become religious has received a very strong blessing, explicit and implicit, in my life from day one. I'm probably heading in on close of time, so I want to relate to the second one, which is the impact of the stories on my relationship with non-Jews. And there's so much to say about all this, but this, I guess, I'll just tell you a quick story. I grew up hating Christmas. I was that Jewish kid that hated Christmas. But not like a little bit, like a lot, with like a lot of resentment. Like the colors red and green make me grit my teeth to this day. And that transformed into a more ideological sense of the wrong that Christianity had done to our people, which I still think is true, but it was a personally held grudge. Until I was sent on shlichut, on a sort of a educational mission, as part of the Beit Midrash that I was founding 5 years ago, 6 years, who knows, to Albany, New York. We were a Yom Yerushalayim 4-day extravaganza together with a Christian evangelical group. So we're standing in the New York State building, and the New York State Senate is voting on a resolution in support of Jerusalem as the happens to be undivided capital of Jewish people, which was a mistake, but a good one. And this Christian pastor we're with, who I kind of just kept my distance from, I have a sense of civility, you know, says to me, "You know, these people think they run the world." And I said, "What?" He said, "Look, they think they run the world." And I had been thinking kind of the same thing. He said, "But we know that God runs the world." And I had this moment of saying, gosh, he's so right. and I cannot afford to write off a whole category of people that I don't know who actually share a fundamental and very important part of my worldview. And so after I got home, I wrote him an email telling him how I'd grown up hating Christians and how, and I had a further conversation with him, although not directly around that topic, and kind of poured my heart out a little bit, and he wrote me back saying, that's amazing, because I grew up hating Jews. And he was he's a very big lover of Israel and an active Christian, and we developed not, I'd say, an intimate relationship after that, but one that I value. And so I'll let that kind of answer that question. And then I am actually at 10 minutes for sure.
No, you're not.
Okay, then.
We have 5 more minutes.
What? There's no inside support going on here. I want to know
one
that.
One day when you're
don't
a teacher, you have a sense of time.
So, you know, the healthy relationship to the Shoah with real understanding and respect of what you said, David, I think that there's a precious opportunity that's lost in us being set up here, but it's the future. The conversation's about and the memories of, as opposed to the lived experience shared, are always the future. And so therefore, to me, actually, I think that a healthy relationship begins with a conversation at this point that is done by those who received the Holocaust as opposed to those who experienced it. Because I don't really think, having grown up with survivors, that there's a healthy conversation to be had there. Like, I grew up, I remember my Aunt Helene, we were sitting there once, and this young couple came in to clean our house. They were quite well off. They were successful builders, better than my family and me. It was like this, they came to America, okay, that was it, boom, succeed. That kind of American story. And this couple walked in, she said, oh, Michael, it's good you're here. What, Aunt Helene? They're Poles, I don't trust them. And she wasn't joking. This young 20-ish couple who was there working hard, and we're sweet, and I interact with them, but that doesn't matter. Or when I sat with her during the war in Bosnia, right, the Balkans War, which I'm sure you all remember, and we were sitting, the TV was on behind us, and I saw this image of these people fleeing on wagons. And I asked her, what does it make you think when you see that? She stopped, and she looked, and there's this old man on the back of the wagon, and she said, I look at him and I say, does he remember what they did to us? You know, like, you have nothing to say to that. I have nothing to say to that. I'll speak in the first person. I have nothing to say to that, which I think is important. You don't have to answer everything. But I think a healthy relationship actually is talking about, is that the life I want to live? Maybe it is. Maybe the answer is yes. Okay. But can we talk about it that way? So these types of conversations are very important to me. And the central lesson I'll just give this to chew on is that there are no boundaries to human moral responsibilities. They're just tactical questions about how you actualize them in the world. Because when you put boundaries on those responsibilities, nothing good comes of it. But if you don't accept the fact that reality puts boundary on your ability to enact them in the world, then nothing good comes of it either. So I'm going to stop there.
Okay, I go.
Mayor, will you just repeat the question that you're going to respond to? Because I'm not sure that everybody knows what question.
Oh, sorry, you guys don't have this in front of you.
Okay, well, actually,
I mean, I emailed it out, but most.
Well, actually, to tell you what, I'm actually going to do things in a different way than Mike. I'm not going to do this like, you know, responding to the specific questions. It's going to be a kind of combination of different things that come up here, so it's going to be interwoven. So I'd rather not, you know, do it that way. Okay, so I want to start out with the following. The reason why I'm on the panel is because my parents were actually Holocaust survivors. and this will reflect also the generational difference between me and Mike. My parents never spoke about the Holocaust. Okay, my parents were, they came from a town in the Ukraine, which today is the Ukraine. They came from the same town. They were married in the middle of the Holocaust. A few months after they were married, they were separated in the sense that because the area which they were in, the Russian troops came in and Germans were then coming in, and my father was taken into the Russian army. My mother was eventually survived the various what are called aktsiot in her ghetto, and she eventually fled when the ghetto was liquidated, and she was hiding in the forest for about 6 months living off berries. She actually saw her sister being killed, who was right next to her. My parents have never spoke about the Holocaust, but what I would say is the Holocaust was kind of in the background in my upbringing, because first of all, the first language that I spoke was actually Yiddish, because my parents spoke Yiddish at home. Secondly, all of their friends were pretty much Holocaust survivors. And to a great extent, I guess, you know, if you had to say when I was growing up, what was, you know, the impact of the Holocaust, it was actually not the destruction and the horror of the Holocaust. It was much more kind of being connected with Jewish life before the Holocaust. Because if anything, my parents would speak about what it was like, right, when they would, you know, have, you know, Jewish holidays, and the food which they had was, you know, Eastern European food, and the people, you know, just, and even just, you know, speaking Yiddish and being introduced to that whole culture. So for me, if anything, the impact which the Holocaust had on me was that it actually connected me with, you know, the pre-Holocaust reality of what Eastern European Jewry was like. So that was number one. Number two, which I think was connected with it, was my parents were very, very proud Jews and in no way wanted to deny their being Jewish. If anything, they wanted to really bring me up with an awareness of who I am as a Jew. And so that what I would say is, for me, probably the most significant thing which came up, okay, and maybe this was, rather than, you know, how do I relate to non-Jews, it was the idea of Jewish continuity. So I'll just tell you one particular thing which, you know, is kind of cute, maybe if some people might see it. I don't even remember this, but my mother at various times would say to me that, first of all, my parents were extremely loving people, were extremely giving, and one of the results of the Holocaust, because my parents got married at a later age and were separated and then only, you know, got back together, which is a whole story in itself, and eventually came to America when my mother was in her late 30s. So I am an only child. And not only am I an only child, but it probably is connected that because of the experiences my mother went through, my childbirth was a very, very difficult thing, and my mother was told categorically that she couldn't have any more children, which for my mother in particular, but my father as well, was a very, very devastating blow. I think for my parents, the most important thing which they wanted was to be able to have kids, to be able to somehow, both of my parents had extensive families. All of their families were wiped out except for my mother having one sister and my father having one brother who survived. Okay, and my parents couldn't have any more children. The most painful thing my mother told me later on, and when I got to be in my 20s and we actually started talking about the Holocaust, was when she said, when you were a little kid, there were times when you used to ask me, how come I don't have any more brothers and sisters, and why am I an only child? And how come I'm different from everybody else that I don't have grandparents and don't have, you know, and for my mother that was extremely painful. Now, the continuation of that story is growing up as an only child, and maybe I decided that I didn't want to have one kid. So for those of you who don't know, I actually have 9 children. I have 27 grandchildren. And my mother, both my parents eventually made Aliyah when I did, which was in 1972. They made 1973. My mother actually lived with us for the last years of her life, the last 8 years of her life. She got to see my children, to actually develop a very close relationship with my children. She even got to see a number of my sons who were in the Israeli army. And at the time when my oldest daughter, my daughter who's number 5, when she was born, she was my first daughter, named after my grandmother. So I spoke at her Simchat Bat, and I said, would my mother have been able to imagine 40 years earlier that 40 years later she would act, when she saw her, or she saw the ghetto being liquidated and everything else, would she be able to imagine that 40 years later she would actually be in Israel, okay, having not only a child but seeing her grandchildren, and even later on, I said, and eventually seeing grandsons who would be in the Israeli army. I said, that's mind-boggling. So the point which I want to make with all that is, for me, a big thing about the Holocaust was the idea of Jewish continuity and the tremendous responsibility which I felt that here I am, I have my family that was wiped out in the Holocaust, that on some level I have to somehow start anew, and I have to continue that line, and I think I made my contribution so far, okay, and my kids are working on the rest of it, okay, but the but for me that was a major part. Okay, growing up, I have to say this, in other words, it was very interesting. I was actually living in two worlds. On the one hand, I was very much through my parents connected with the Eastern European world. And on the other hand, just with my general circle of people, I was living in an American reality, right? Doing, you know, what every other normal American kid does. And somehow it was like I found a way of somehow merging those two worlds. I never grew up with a hatred, right, of non-Jews. In fact, I would interact with all kinds of non-Jews. We played ball together. We did all kinds of other things. But my circle was not a non-Jewish circle. My circle was very much Jewish. And as a result of that, I think it was also natural that in the end I decided that I would come to Israel. I would just say one... Can I still have a minute?
Yes, you do.
I would just say that I do share with Mike something which for me is a big takeaway from the Holocaust, that... I don't have as much a problem with where was God in the Holocaust as with where were people in the Holocaust. And as a result of that, so for me a big thing is a very real, I don't have a rosy image of people. In other words, the idea being that as a result of what happened in the Holocaust, I have a very profound sense of what it means to have evil in the world and what it means to not necessarily be able to rely on the goodwill of others when that's happening. And as a result of that, that means that when I see things which are going on, right, today or even not today, that I see as evil, then I want to recognize that as evil. And when I also see people who will say, well, don't worry, you know, if... For example, being in Israel, right? In other words, if anything would ever happen in Israel, right? America, whoever it is, will come to your support. I don't believe it. And that's why, for me, probably one of the most disturbing things that's happening today, and which, for me, brings up the images of the Holocaust, is when I see what goes on in Syria. When you can have hundreds of thousands of people who are being butchered, when you have civilians who are being killed by chemical warfare, when you have millions of refugees, and nobody is doing anything. And then when I see that, then I understand what happened in the Holocaust. Because then I really see, in other words, because you ask yourself, how could it be that these things go on and people aren't doing anything? And yes. And then what I find is, and that maybe is a very sad statement about our reality. And maybe that means that at times, right, in other words, then we have to acknowledge that, okay, and what do you do about that? That's a very interesting question, but at least to recognize that maybe things have not dramatically changed with everything, and that's something that we have to come to terms with. Okay, I think I...
Okay. Can you hear me in the back?
Yeah.
Yes? Okay. So I'm really here actually, I think, as a product of my own home, but also since I've been together with my wife since we were teenagers, also her home as well, a home that she grew up in as well. My wife, Ricky, grew up in a home of two sole survivors of very large extended families. Her mother grew up in Lodz, which was the second largest city in Poland, to a wealthy family. She was the only daughter. She had, I think, four brothers. She was the sole survivor. She was in the Ludge Ghetto, and then she was at Auschwitz and survived the death march. And her father, my father-in-law, both of them, Alehi Amashalom, my father-in-law comes from a small shtetl called Zwolin in Poland, and was actually in the Polish army, was taken as a prisoner, and spent the war years in three different concentration or labor camps, and survived the war that way. He was also the sole survivor. He lost, in addition to his siblings and parents, he lost a wife and two children. They never spoke about their experiences. Once in a while, they would say something, but rarely. We never were able to get really the full story from either of them. My parents also were born in Poland. They were born in eastern Poland and the part of Poland that was taken over first by the Russians in 1939. They both came from the same town, and they were both members in a left-wing Zionist movement, youth movement called the Shomer Tzair. They both rebelled against their religious parents at a young age. And they managed to survive because they escaped ahead of the German advance. When the Germans invaded in July 1940, at the end of June 1941, through various, I won't go into the whole story, but various miraculous things, my parents were able to both escape. They took their siblings with them, except for one. That sibling and their parents were killed by the Germans. And they didn't know Russian, they had no money, and they managed to survive the war in the Soviet Union through a series of miraculous events. They were separated as well. My father was called up into the Russian army, and they were separated numerous times and somehow found each other and were reunited at the end of the war. I have an older sister who was born towards the end of the war in Poland. My parents came to America in 1946, and they were very proud of the fact that they actually came on the first refugee ship that came from Europe to the United States after the war. They had been in a DP camp, and my father's picture was in the foreword. And he was interviewed by WEVD, the Yiddish radio station that existed in New York at the time. So I grew up in a home that was similar to Mayer's, I think, in many ways. It was a Yiddish-speaking home, not a religious home, but a very Jewish home in many ways. My bedtime stories were stories about life before the war in Brody in Poland. My bedtime stories are about my parents' escape and the unbelievable decisions they had to make, life and death decisions, to board this train, to stay where they were. How do you get on that train when it's a military train? How do you get food? All of those stories were my bedtime stories. I never heard of fairy tales until I was a teenager. I didn't know such things existed. And I never asked about grandparents because in my parents' circles, nobody had grandparents. So that was the norm. It's actually one of the strange things of my life that I'm a grandparent now because I never had a model of a grandparent. So how does the Shoah influence my identity, worldview, and action? First of all, our children are all named for the family that was killed. I'm named for my two grandfathers. My wife is named for her two grandmothers. So that's very much a part of our life and our children's lives. I think that at a certain point, I think when I was in college, it began to dawn on me that 90% of Polish Jews were murdered. It's 9 out of 10. Only 1 out of 10 survived the war. And I began to have this feeling that there had to be a reason why my parents survived. There had to be a reason why I came into this world, and that I had to make my life worthwhile. And so while I had always been told that I would make a good lawyer, and I was interested in history and political science and always thought I was going to go to law school, at a certain point in college, I decided to go into Jewish education because I didn't think another Jewish lawyer would make such a big difference in the world. But I was hopeful that a Jewish educator might make a greater difference. Attitudes towards non-Jews. My parents always spoke about how the Russian peasants took them into their homes. They didn't know them. They would knock on somebody's door, sometimes in the middle of the night, and people not only let them stay over in their home, but they fed them. And my mother told me there were times when they gave them their bedroom. And they would say, these Russian peasants, according to my mother, they would say, you know, our child is somewhere at the front or somewhere else, and we hope that somebody is doing this for them too. Kind of a, you know, pay it forward kind of mentality. And so I always grew up, I never grew up with a feeling of hatred towards non-Jews. It was non-Jews who saved my parents' life more than once. About the question of what a healthy relationship to the Shoah would look like. I agree with Mike that, you know, sort of can't rely on survivors for this because they've been traumatized and they have every right to have whatever relationship they have. But I think for us, you know, I find it very sad that in some Jewish circles, and the Pew study showed this as well, the Shoah plays such an outsized role in people's Jewish identity. I mean, I know why it plays a large role in my identity, but even in my identity, my parents made sure I went to a Jewish day school so that I would learn Hebrew, so that I would learn Chumash, so that I would learn everything about what Judaism has to offer, and Jewish history. You know, the Shoah is only one episode of all of Jewish history, not to mention that it's only one piece of Jewish life. And to think about the overemphasis, and I'm speaking here, some of you know, as somebody who takes groups to Poland all the time, who's taught the Shoah for many decades, but the overemphasis on the Shoah in Jewish life, not because it's overemphasized, really, but because the rest of Jewish life is so underemphasized. The rest of Jewish life is almost hidden from most Jews living in the Western world today. I find that so sad, because the Shoah should be taught, yes, and I happen to think that it's a very important thing for people to visit places of Jewish heritage, not only Poland, and not only places of death, but places of Jewish life. But I sort of view what we do at Pardes as kind of being the right kind of proportion. Yeah, we're going to talk about the Shoah from time to time, but most of the time we're going to study the rest of Jewish history, the rest of Judaism, because just to see the Shoah without a context is actually, I think, to rob people not only of the riches of Jewish life, but even of the richness of Jewish life that existed before the Shoah. And so I think it does a disservice to the Shoah, even to the memory of the victims as well as the survivors, not to be viewing the Shoah in a much broader context, and that is the context of Jewish life, which includes a lot of celebration and not only mourning.
Thank you. Everyone really stayed within their time limit, so thank you very much. Before we turn to student questions, does anybody want to add something to what they said? Maybe somebody said something that brought something additional up for you that you want to add before we go to questions?
If I could just respond to the last thing you said, David, because it gave me a clear term for what I was looking for, is that we haven't found a way to integrate the Shoah into our education. I want to very strongly echo what Dave was saying, is that outsized proportion and how it's not just outsized, but everything else is undersized. I think it's because of a struggle to be able to tell any story of Jewish history or theology or Torah that actually could, what would be the Shoah in its right place, I guess, is that's what that left me with. It's a really important question. I really appreciate that. I just wanted to emphasize that.
Okay, so I'll take a couple questions and just say whether it's for a specific person or if anyone can. Okay, we'll start over here, Jason.
Well, first of all, everything also was very beautiful. And David, what you just said about contextualizing the Holocaust is, I think, especially important, practically speaking. You know, how do we learn about it? Of course, we see the Holocaust from a Jewish lens. How do we fit the Holocaust into the other Jewish context? But my question is about the other context of the Holocaust, namely being situated in World War II, which is the bloodiest conflict humans have ever experienced. My question is, do you think seeing or learning about the context, a little bit more about the history of World War II, might enrich or change our perception of what the Holocaust was? For example, I think it's estimated that 27 million Russians were murdered, about 5 million Germans died, 1 million Yugoslavians died. Like, millions of people were murdered. Jews were the only people who were explicitly genocided in World War II. But I wonder if maybe our perception of sort of the Gentiles' role in the Holocaust might change if we understand just how many people suffered at the same time that the Holocaust was going on.
I'll be happy to answer that. I mean, as a student of history, I think that is the proper way to study the Shoah in the context of World War II. Historians estimate about 60 million people were murdered in World War II. And I would add, you know, the Roma and Sinti, or gypsies, as sometimes they're called, were also objects of Nazi genocide. I think it gets even more depressing because, you know, it would be easier, quote unquote, if we could say, well, you know what, 6 million Jews were murdered, or 5.5 million Jews were murdered, and the world didn't care. But actually, 60 million people were murdered. And actually, and again, I'm echoing what I think Mayer and Mike were saying about Syria. It is really something that one has to see for its reality and its truth, and it's so painful to say. But we can't be naive about the way the world works. We're fooling ourselves if we believe that the world is as compassionate as we would want it to be. And in truth, it's if you're not self-reliant, you can't expect others to help you. Maybe that's actually true in our individual lives as well. I hope not. But it's certainly true in the history of nations. And so, in a way, I almost would say it's easier if we could just view it all through the prism of anti-Semitism. But it's not just that. Yes, anti-Semitism, of course, plays a very big role in the Shoah. But when you look at more broadly at World War II, or at events in the world today, you understand that it's far beyond that. If you're not self-reliant as a nation, watch out. Don't expect anybody to come help you.
I've got to respond. It makes me very uncomfortable to say that 60 million people were murdered in World War II. War and murder are not the same thing. They're not. And we're not going to parse out civilians in war and soldiers and societies that go to war and the victim and the... But you could study... I'm also a student of history, and I think it is a proper way to study the Holocaust and putting it in its context. But if you want to learn it, it's a different task. And I think that we as a people have an obligation to learn it. The historians can study it, and some of us are historians as well, but this question of the central lesson and that difference between war and murder, I don't see any equivalency at all, and I'm very wary, in fact, of the desire to contextualize and universalize, despite the fact that I absolutely agree with you that the problem hasn't gone away, nor is it a Jewish problem. Nevertheless, I don't think we as Jews can actually help that problem if we fall into the trap of an over-contextualization of something which needs to be learned as well as studied.
Okay, I just want to say one thing also. As somebody who's not a student of history,
come on, everybody's a student of history.
Well, you know, professional. Okay, so in any case, I agree with the things that were said, but I just want to say another thing, which I think also that, you know, you're putting a big, tremendous emphasis, and very often we do put the emphasis on the people who were murdered. But I think that there's another thing which is also extremely important to realize in the Holocaust. You're talking about a whole onslaught of a culture, belief system. In other words, it wasn't just Jews who were being killed. It was Judaism that was trying to be eradicated. And that's why I think that also what David was saying before about, you know, how it's sad that Judaism is not studied enough. Because, you know, there's the question today, which a number of people say, of to what extent is it that, you know, people are basically completing Hitler's work by assimilating and kind of rejecting Judaism? And that, because it wasn't just a question of destroying all these Jews, it was a question of everything that they believe in, everything that they try to create in the world. And so therefore, I think that that's something that has to be considered very seriously also. And not only that, but to see how that also is part of a much larger historical context in terms of Jewish history, of how throughout Jewish history, it wasn't just a question of Jews being killed, but ultimately what Jews believed in and were trying to bring to the world.
Okay, I want to get to other questions. Gavin?
So my question is for Dean Bernstein. You used the phrase I've heard today, that there's different contexts, so it was very Jewish household, but not religious. I've worked in many different B'tei Chabad, and I've heard this many, many different times from my participants. But I think the biggest thing that was different from your generation and my generation is your generation had lots of Jewish education, lots of emphasis on going to day school. My generation has all but lost that. And so I'm curious what you think we could do as future Jewish leaders to help fix this problem, given a lot of American Jews have been kind of burned by Israel in many different ways, one being the Kotel Agreement. A lot of progressive Jews were very burned by that. And so I'm just curious how we could begin to mend fences and prevent that completing Hitler's desire of eradicating Judaism.
So you're asking a very big question, Gavin. But I would say the beginning is actually right here. You know, every one of you actually took a very big step. Some of you had an intensive Jewish education before you came, and some of you had less of a Jewish education before you came. But every one of you took a step, a big step, out of the railroad of life. You got off, and you're spending a lot of time here learning a tremendous amount. As I said, on the first day of school here, next year, if you're not back here and you're going back to wherever you come from, you will be the most learned Jew at some point or another. You'll be the most learned Jew in the room, either in your school or in your workplace or in your family, you're going to be the most learned Jew in the room. And so, you know, to me, Jewish literacy, and I mean by that not only the ability to read and write, but I mean the ability to read and write Jewish things, but I also mean Jewish life literacy. I think that all of you have taken that step, and everything that we can do in the Jewish world around us, amongst our friends, amongst our family, in our communities, to further that, that's the most important thing we can do.
Yeah, but I would just add something, since, you know, our backgrounds are very, very similar. In other words, with my parents were actually, you know, on a certain level, what you would call illiterate Jews. In other words, my parents never received any formal education. All of their Judaism was something which they absorbed in their homes. It was they absorbed through experience. And I would just add to what David said. In other words, I think that on the one hand, so for people who are growing up in a reality that you're describing, Gavin, so the way that you somehow come to Judaism is through learning. But at a certain point, the learning is not enough in and of itself. There has to be some sort of environment that you create, experience that you create, which is then the expression of that learning. And I think that's what's extremely, you know, lacking today, that somehow that Jewish experience is not maybe at the core of people's homes. And so that, you know, so I think that this is kind of the beginning, but somehow that has to be recreated.
I'll just add one thing. This is another conversation that comes either on top of or through or by that is, why be Jewish? I mean, I grew up in a, aside from my sort of Holocaust received experience, I went to public school my whole life, all the way through grad school, and the primary emphasis of my education was on the Holocaust. 6 million people died, marry a Jew. I found a lot more through camping and through youth group and through who I am. My brother at a certain point said, well, that's just racist. I'm going to marry someone I love. And he and I have had subsequent conversations about them, very few, but a lot of it is boils down to if you can't make an honest expression of why be Jewish, then all those fights being burned by this or argument over that, it's I'm going to take my ball and go home. I'm not playing anymore. So here in our national expression, that answer can be even a self-fulfilling prophecy. Why be Jewish? Because we're Jewish, we have a state, etc. In the diaspora, it's a real question. So it's a worthwhile conversation as well.
A few more questions, Rachel.
Thank you for being willing to come up and to share your stories in all of its various stages. And like you, Mike, I grew up in the public schools. I wasn't Jewish educated really at all. But I did know about the Holocaust. And somewhere in my early teenage years, I started to learn about the German side of the story. And, oh, wait, there were other people that also died in the Holocaust outside of the Jews. And so it started to irritate me when I got into, like, high school and what have you. And they only seemed to focus it in on the Jewish story. And they didn't look at it in a more holistic perspective, and especially coming from a public school system, it was like this. Yes, this is a Jewish story. Yes, mamash, like what happened should not have happened, and there should have been, you know, more of an intervention on some formal level. But it's like, how do I tell us, you know, the person who's like, well, I'm adopted, so I would have been born regardless, you know, regardless of if my adopted grandparents had died, you know, in the Holocaust or what have you, like, how do you explain this to people who don't have that immediacy of the Holocaust really in their home because they're coming from the non-Jewish perspective? And how do I teach that in a way that still incorporates all those other narratives, the German side, the homosexuals, the Romani, as you mentioned? Like, how do I go about educating and teaching that?
I think we have a model, and it's we just finished the sort of height of that model in the telling of the story of the Exodus
at Seder, right? That model of memory of as a act, as a recollection, as a model education, it's there for us, but it takes a huge investment. I mean, on some level, I feel like we have to talk about the Holocaust more rather than less, but in healthier and more effective ways. Because I agree with you, David, that sort of outsized sort of like takeover. I was a victim of that, so to speak, in my education. There was a point at which it was like, honestly, I'm done with this. It's ridiculous. It's a terrible way to see the world. Right? But that's not a conversation that has to happen less. It's one that has to happen in a healthy way. So finding those tools of memory, and that's just a brief answer because it's also a big question, but that's what I would say.
Does anyone else want to relate to that, or should we take it?
I just want to clarify so nobody should misunderstand me, that I'm not advocating less Holocaust education. I'm just advocating more Jewish education. Okay?
Hey, Manny.
Yeah. My question is mostly for Mayor, because my experience is that I also grew up with a lot of survivors, children who were survivors of Holocaust. So as a question that, how did you feel having parents from the Holocaust growing up in America with other kids who were not survivors? Did you feel your parents were different than them? And did it affect you growing up? And my second question is, do you feel you were pushed more to succeed because of your parents, or was that your own motivation?
Oh, look, I'll say two things. I'll tell you one story which is very interesting. I had, some people may know the story, I had an eighth grade Rebbe when let me start the other side. One of the things which is absolutely critical for my parents was that they felt that I had to get a Jewish education. Especially my mother. My mother was the driving force. She said, you have to get a Jewish education. And in true Pardes fashion, she then said, and you can do whatever you want with it, but at least be an educated Jew, right? In other words, and I think it was extremely important, because this is, again, part of the continuity of Judaism that they felt that I should have. Okay, so that... Now, I never... You know, my parents, I think, worked very, very hard to become, I wouldn't use the term integrated into American society, but to somehow be able to make it in American society. I mean, they learned the language, they spoke with an accent, but not a really thick accent, but they still spoke with an accent. They, you know, did not make it in the sense of, you know, you'd probably say lower income. I grew up living, I didn't have my own bedroom. I, you know, slept in the living room because my parents did not. And my parents made a very meager salary, but they insisted on sending me to a yeshiva, right, to get a Jewish education. And they never went on trips, never went to restaurants, did not have anything which whatever money they had, they put into me getting a Jewish education. Now, the fact is, so I went to yeshiva, and I had an eighth grade Rebbe who was also a survivor, who had actually learned in the Mir Yeshiva and had gone through Shanghai, and it was a whole story, who had real Eastern European, thick, very, very thick accent. And it was very interesting, just sociologically. Most of the kids who were with me in yeshiva when I was studying were kids who, you know, were kids of American parents. And I could see it when it was happening. I distinctly remember that most of the time the kids in the class would really laugh at this Rebbe and couldn't connect with this Rebbe. And it was like, you know, he's from a whole other planet. For me, I loved him. Okay, and just to tell you, some people know the story. What happened was, this was after about, I don't know, well, it was when I was in about 8 years later, let's say, after I had not seen this person, my wife and I had gotten engaged, and then I decided that, you know, after we got engaged, that we would spend Simchat Torah with my wife's aunt in Borough Park. So we went to Borough Park, and then I said, you know what, I really want to daven in yeshiva, because I had just been in yeshiva before that. So we went to this yeshiva, Chaim Berlin. Here I go to Chaim Berlin, Simchat Torah. Lo and behold, who do I see? My eighth grade Rebbe. So it was like, it was very emotional, because I was very happy to see him. Of course, he remembered me. And then he said, and what you doing? So I started explaining to him, you know, I was getting to Yeshiva University, I was getting my degree. And then I said, oh, and this is, by the way, my fiance, right, and we're going to be getting married. And then he goes, when you get married? So I say to him, we're getting married this was in October, right, Simchat Torah, we're getting married in June, and then we're going to make Aliyah. So he looks at me and he goes, 4 months. So I said, what do you mean? He said, you get married in 4 months. Okay. So here we are, right? We left. And then I'm thinking to myself, and we were talking about it, and I said, you know, the truth is I'd really like to get married in 4 months, but it's just not practical, I mean, because it means I'm going to be getting married in the middle of my last year of college, and then, you know, and my wife is also studying, and like, you know, how are we going to get an apartment, and especially since we are making Aliyah, we're going to be making Aliyah, like, within a short time. Anyway, to make a long story short, we got married within 4 months, and he was the rabbi who performed our wedding.
Wow.
So, but the point which I want to make with that is, this is the long answer to your question, Manny, that I always felt very, very comfortable with both worlds. And I didn't feel in any way embarrassed, right, about the connection with those people who were refugees and everything else. And if anything, I really appreciated them. I valued them. And sometimes that created a certain dissonance with the kids that I was growing up with, because they found it extremely difficult to relate to the refugees. And so I found myself, in a certain sense, being a kind of bridge between two worlds.
Hey, Ruby.
That's what I mean.
The Holocaust narrative is used as a comparison or even as a justification for in modern politics, I think, all the time. I mean, you even made a comparison with Syria. And I think people use it all the time in the debates about the refugees, both here and in America. Are there times when you feel like that comparison is appropriate versus times when you heard it used that maybe feel offensive or inappropriate? And like, where do you draw that distinction? Where do you draw that line?
Sure. People use it all the time inappropriately. I'm sorry if I gave the impression that I was equating what's happening in Syria to the Holocaust. I was just talking about human suffering in general, and massacres, and et cetera. That's the level on which I would compare them. I think it's people use it all the time, and I call it a form of Holocaust denial. I'll give you an example. When the disengagement took place in Gaza, so somebody had the very bright idea that since people were being thrown out of their houses, which was definitely traumatic for those people, they should wear yellow armbands with a Magen David. And all I could think about was, if what the Nazis had done to my grandparents was to throw them out of the house, I might have been able to meet them. So people abuse it all the time, and by the way, people on the left abuse it, people on the right abuse it, Jews abuse it, non-Jews abuse it, and tragically, there are very, very few things that actually really can be compared. Human suffering, of course, is very widespread, and massacres take place, unfortunately, in the world all the time, but the Shoah itself is a unique story, and here I guess I'm also answering Rachel. Even within all of the story of World War II, the Shoah is a unique story within all of that.
Yeah, I would just like to say I agree with everything that David said, and when I also mentioned about the business of Syria and the Shoah, the thing which I really wanted to just emphasize was that, in other words, when I see what's going on in Syria, so it helps me better understand what happened in the Shoah in the sense that I just find it mind-boggling that how could you have a situation of people who are being murdered and yet, and people know about it, and yet people are just, you know, totally, right, not willing to reel, and especially people who you would expect should be reacting, okay? And, you know, so that could be the American government, that could be American Jews, that could be, so for me, it's more, for me, that I can somehow get an insight into something. But I agree with David absolutely that, in other words, I am extremely wary about, you know, using that term other than with respect to the Shoah.
If I can add, the place, if I was going to try to draw a distinction, is the place where talking about suffering and using the Shoah as an example, I think, to me, I can't countenance. But if you're trying to identify evil, which is an important word to me in any discussion of the Shoah, that's why I find it gets so abused. Because, like I agree with you, David, it's like human suffering is human suffering, and we could talk about more or less, and I think that's kind of a useless discussion. But what we're willing to name as evil and what that demands of us if we are is why it's so awful to hear it pulled out at random. Like, you know, you guys have probably seen that meme, right? The emotional child's guide to, you know, to using Hitler in your arguments, right? Everybody becomes Hitler, and therefore, like David's saying, it's a complete denial of. But yet, at the same time, what it is, I think we're all flailing around with this idea of evil. We don't want to touch it. Everybody knows it's there. We all see it in ourselves, in others, and it's hard to deal with. So that's, to me, the place where it actually becomes potentially useful, with all the pain and danger around it.
We don't have a lot of time. But this panel is meant to be the beginning of a discussion, as all of our panels are. So we hope that the conversation will continue beyond the bounds of this specific time. But we are going to have one more question.
I wanted to ask how God was talked about and discussed, if at all, in your homes growing up. And if you feel comfortable talking about it, how your upbringing sort of shapes the way that, you know, as adults do, you think about questions of God and chosen.
Okay, I'll start. In other words, my parents, it's very interesting. My parents, I think I said, were illiterate in the sense that they never received a formal Jewish education. But I think both of my parents had a profound belief in God. And that profound belief also connected them very much Jewishly. And I think that was transmitted to me. And so that I think from a very, very early age, right, I grew up with that connection with God. And I think, you know, different people have different experiences, but for my parents, having gone through the Shoah, that did not in any way raise for them all kinds of theological questions or, you know, say, God, if anything, I think it maybe even made God a more central thing in their lives. Okay, and I think that for that reason, that's why it wasn't, you know, for my parents, it was never an issue. My parents, you know, did go to shul, and they did try to keep kosher, and they tried to keep up everything that they did. And for my parents, when I was going to yeshiva and becoming more observant and maybe anchoring it in learning, so my parents naturally also came back to many, many different things. So I think, so for me, God has always been a very central part of my experience.
My mother had a direct line of communication with God. She spoke to God all the time. Not in her heart, out loud. She would say, Rabbeinu Shalaylam, how could you let this happen? She would be talking to God all the time. My father less so. And I mentioned my parents rebelled against their religious homes in which they grew up in, which was very typical of early 20th century Polish Jewish families. After they came to America, I think they started to become more traditional, even though they weren't Shomer Shabbos. They had a furniture store that was open on Shabbat. My mother lit Shabbat candles, but not necessarily on time, and Mayer said it very elegantly. They tried to keep a kosher home, as much as she knew. But I think that God was something that was very present in our home, mostly through my mother. I often think about how, you know, on the one hand, I'm quote-unquote more religious, which means more observant than my mother, but I doubt that I will ever have the connection to God that she had.
I'll just add, I mean, growing up with the survivors of my family, like I said, they were very religious, and most of them dropped it. My Aunt Helene told me a story. She remembers my grandfather was the oldest brother of 11. He was like the shining light of the family. That's why he got out. And she said, she remembered when got them over to America, the first Yom Kippur, on the morning Yom Kippur, her brother got in a car to drive to shul. And she told me she was certain that lightning would come from the sky and strike him dead. And that's not a joke. And when it didn't, on one level, everything changed. On the other hand, she had a kosher house. She has a kosher house to this very day. She's 90 years old. Right? So I grew up with this sense of almost a contract that needed to be renegotiated. And that's had a lot of impact on me.
Can I just add?
If it's quick, because there's one we want to finish.
1947, my parents came over in 1929 to Canada from Poland. 1947, my father was at the lawyer's office trying to bring people in after the war. And this was the time the first refugee, survivor came to Toronto. He's in the lawyer's office. And my father had this view that when they came out, none of them would believe. After having lived through the Holocaust, how could you possibly believe in God? Came home that day, and I'll never forget it. He said, 20 after 4, the survivor had been talking to him about things, and he said, looks at his wife, he said, oh, it's time to daven mincha. And that really threw my father, because he just did not expect them to continue with the observance after what they had gone through. And of course, many did. Many didn't. I mean, you got lots of split. But it just really was something that sort of stuck with me all those years. That how he was delighted, but on the side, and surprised at the same time that this was happening.
So we're gonna end with one final question. I just really hope that this the panel modeling, reflecting their own relationship to the Holocaust, will help everybody here process what your relationship to the Shoah is as we approach Yom HaShoah, and that we'll have many more meaningful conversations after the panel. So the final question is, what does never again mean to you?
Okay, I'll start. I heard many lectures by Elie Wiesel on Lev HaShalom. And Elie Wiesel was once asked, what's the lesson of the Shoah? And his answer was that you can get away with it. So I think that saying never again is sort of like a hope. It's a nice hope. But unless you really narrow it down very much, I think that it might be a naive hope. So I tend not to think in terms of the negative of never again, but rather I like to think more of the positive in terms of what we were talking about before about building Jewish life. If the Nazis sought to destroy Jewish life, then one response to the Shoah is to try to build Jewish life. And I think that everything we do to build Jewish life and build Jewish community is a, to me, maybe a better response than never again. And I'll take the liberty of just sharing one story that is sort of tangential, but I just feel the need to share it. When I was about 10 years old, my mother said to me, Tatala, which is what she called me. Tatala. My sister was Mamama. Tatala, red a bissel Yiddish. Speak a little Yiddish. Because they were speaking Yiddish to themselves, and I would understand, but I would answer in English. And I was a very chutzpahdik 10-year-old. And I said, I was going to Jewish day school. It was an Ivrit be Ivrit, you know, it was a Hebrew language day school. And I said, I'm learning Hebrew. Yiddish is the language of the exiles. My mother should have slapped me in the face.
Yeah.
But
Ben Gurion would have loved you.
What?
Ben Gurion would
have loved
you.
Ben Gurion would have loved me, yeah. She should have slapped me in the face. But a Yiddish mama loves her son too much, and she didn't do that. Instead, she said to me, Tato, red a bissel Yiddish, because if you speak Yiddish, one day there will be a Jew somewhere that you'll be able to help. First of all, the perspective of learn a language, because one day there'll be somebody you'll be able to help. So, all right, you know, she said it to me. I was about 10 years old. Fast forward about 15 years, like Mayer, my wife and I were sent to the Soviet Union to meet with refuseniks, Jews who had asked to make Aliyah and were being refused and were being persecuted in the Soviet Union. And now it can be said the Israeli government was sending Americans and Brits and other people to try to encourage that movement and help those people. So this is the early 1970s. And we go to the Soviet Union, and we are in places in the Baltic states, etc., where a lot of the refuseniks didn't speak English, and a lot of them didn't speak Hebrew, and we didn't speak Russian. How did we communicate with them? We communicated with them in Yiddish. For 3 weeks, my wife and I spoke Yiddish, so much so that we were dreaming, literally dreaming, having dreams in Yiddish. So when I came home, I was able to tell my mother that she was right. And it took me until I was in my 20s to realize that a Yiddish imam is always right.
Never again for me, never again, I think connected to something I said before about maybe my absorption with Jewish continuity. And that can be expressed in terms of building. I think that can be expressed in terms of why I decided to become an educator and devote my whole life to that. And I think that can be expressed in the fact that, in other words, I decided to make Aliyah. And that can also be expressed in the fact of what Mike said earlier, why I will do everything to see to it that Israel will continue to exist, and whatever it takes to defend Israel.
So just really briefly, I mean, there's so much. There's a whole book that could be written on the tension, the particular, the universal. But I would say that more than anything else, Never Again to me says the power of one good slogan to destroy 1,000 good conversations. It just floats around out there, and it just eats up so much of the important things that we need to talk about.
Thank you very much to our panelists.
The Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.